Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Book Spider podcast, a Book of the Week format podcast, which has long prided itself on being the driest and most analytically rigorous of literature podcasts, the one book podcast that makes no concessions at all to being accessible or entertaining. Today, we're actually undergoing a format change that will be mostly invisible to our listeners, but that may affect the tone somewhat, which is that we have moved to an afternoon time slot for recording. That may shift the vibe a little bit. I'm a little worried that the atmosphere here may become less classroom, more late night party. But I'm hoping you gentlemen will work with me in keeping that in check and keeping the usual level of dryness and dullness. I am Hans Berger, and as always, I am joined by Chris Malmberg and Patrick Barney, the other standard Book Spider hosts. This week, we're going to be also joined by my friend Sarah Ashcraft, who is going to help us talk about Unbearable Lightness of Being, Milan Kundera's, I believe, 1984 novel. And I had some conversations with her about some perspectives she had on the book that I thought were interesting, and that was actually what led me to pick it for the podcast today. So I thought it would be interesting to have her on as a guest. Now, The Unbearable Lightness of Being is, of course, a really remarkably appealing but at the same time deceptively complex novel which uses philosophy to interrogate the nature of sex under Soviet communism, the nature of political life under Soviet communism, perhaps of the relationship between those two things. We'll talk a bit more about how those elements are intertwined, and addresses quite a lot of other topics, and does so in a way where, you know, the treatment of those topics, I think, makes intuitive sense, but maybe can be a little bit hard to consciously explain. Now, the basic outlines of the plot don't really take up too much space. The novel focuses primarily on Tomas and Teresa, a couple who live in Czechoslovakia in the 60s. Tomas is, at least at the start of the narrative, a womanizing doctor who lives in Prague. Teresa is a waitress who lives in a rural part of the country. He meets her in her home village. She travels to Prague to see him. They sleep together. She travels to Prague again and moves in with him. And he does all this perhaps somewhat against his better judgment as a long-term inveterate womanizer. And you could argue based mostly on pity for her, maybe more so than romantic attraction, though I think I'll be interested in talking a bit about his motivations and why he does some of the things that he does. After they get together, he does continue having affairs, and later they move to Zurich together, but she returns to Prague after a certain period of time. He follows her, again for unclear reasons, again perhaps contrary to his own better judgment. He loses the ability to practice medicine due to an article that he's written for a newspaper, which is critical of the communist regime, or the Communist Party at least. Then he becomes a window washer. They move to the country. Their dog dies of cancer. They realize they're happy together. Their truck rolls down a hill, and they die. But that sequence of events, even though it seems relatively straightforward, laid out in chronological order, is told in a relatively complex way that frequently doubles back to earlier scenes to provide additional detail about context or motivation or reasoning or character background that changes the way that we perceive or understand a scene that's already happened in the novel. And I really don't think that I can account for, I don't think I can construct a summary that accounts for all the thematic and psychological complexity that's given to those incidents, but perhaps we can touch on those in some more depth as we go. I should say, too, that interspersed with Tomas and Teresa's stories are those of Sabina, his occasional lover, and Sabina's other lover, Franz. Sabina develops a political perspective which might be described as anti-kitsch and moves to America. Franz drastically misunderstands her ideas and her perceptions of his strength. He engages in certain very kitschy forms of political activism and is eventually murdered. So did you guys have anything you wanted to add to that basic synopsis? Does that seem appropriate just to start us off?
Mm-hmm. Seems good.
The first question that I had, and I think I touched on this a bit when I was going through the condensed version, but my sense of this novel has always been that it is easy to read but difficult to talk about, if that makes sense, right? It's remarkably accessible and entertaining, given that it's nonlinear, it's in translation, it's loaded with references to philosophy. But now that I've put myself in the position of having to direct a discussion about it, I'm having trouble saying on a broad scale exactly what it does or what it says or what it's about, right? It's very episodic. It's very digressive. It uses vignettes to illustrate abstract philosophical points. So I guess my first question is just, do the rest of you experience that same effect where this is very easily readable, easily approachable, but kind of deceptively difficult to sum up or talk about or draw themes from, right? And if so, why do you think that is?
I do not have that experience. My experience is certainly that it's accessible, it's entertaining, but it doesn't seem to me to be that difficult. Like, it's difficult to talk about if we have difficulty talking about it, but it doesn't seem that, like, opaque to me. It seems relatively open to thematic investigation, to technical investigation. So no, I don't know. It doesn't seem like it would be that difficult to talk about.
I'm probably somewhere in between. I'm curious, Patrick, you say you don't think it'd be difficult to talk about. I think that it's definitely open because the narrator, I think, is very explicit about the things that he wants us to think about, or, you know. And so I think that's true, but I also think that I'm not sure. Do you feel like the themes of the novel cohere into something that is, like, clear? Or because I think that, you know, one of the things, you know, lightness and it's opposite, you know, it feels kind of like it feels like there's kind of this thing where a lot of the themes are sort of being, a lot of concepts are being juxtaposed in a way that, like, I don't know that there's a clear sort of coherence to the novel as a whole. And maybe that's what, Hans, you're talking about?
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm talking about. I think there's actually kind of, for me, there's a paradoxical effect where, because the thematic underpinning of everything is spelled out so clearly, it's like it almost becomes a series of miniature essays in a way. And if, I mean, and we've talked a little bit, I think, in the past about how the format of let's all talk about what this book means, I think, creates the expectation that everything can cohere into some kind of unified statement, right? Like that ultimately you should be able to boil everything down to one or two sentences, right? And I think when we were talking about, if I remember right, The Furrows by Namwali Sirpel, one thing that came up then was the sense that that's kind of an arbitrary expectation, right? I mean, that was a novel that was, like, partly about race and partly about class and partly about the nature of memory. And I kind of kept trying to push us to kind of, okay, well, like, how do those three themes add up to one kind of super theme, right? And the fact that all the thematic bits are laid out so neatly here makes it paradoxically harder to kind of tie them together into a super theme. And that might be more what I meant. I think you articulated that pretty well, Chris.
Patrick, do you feel differently about, like, because I think that it's generative. I don't think that it's a critical or it's not something that is a weakness of the novel for me. I like, you know, we return to this conversation a lot about, like, me liking being confused. and I'm not confused here. I guess it's a little bit more of a state of like curiosity and wonderment and being in a place of unknowing amidst all of these different avenues of, you know, sort of philosophical inquiries is a comfortable space for me. But I was curious about what you were saying, you know, does it feel like it has a thesis, I guess?
I don't know if I think it has a specific thesis, but I do feel like most of the thematic content in the novel seems like it can be related to, you know, something that Nietzsche has talked about. Not always specifically the concept of eternal return, but certainly many things seem very Nietzschean to me, like the idea of anti-kitsch, which super interesting passage, very enjoyable. And Nietzsche was just, you know, a totally individualist thinker and philosopher. So kitsch would have been anathema to him. So it seems to me that most of what's said, looked at through a Nietzschean lens, makes sense. You know, even the technique of doubling back on different events, like we first learn that Tomas and Teresa die in a truck accident through the point of view of Sabina. But in Tomas and Teresa, from Tomas and Teresa's perspective, we haven't gotten there yet. Like we're listening to, reading Tomas and Teresa's story. We jump over to Sabina, who's like a few years ahead of her, of them. She reads about their deaths. Then we bounce back to Tomas and Teresa, who then go on to, you know, do window washing and living in a rural area and then eventually dying. That technique definitely seems like it could be fit into the eternal return idea. So I don't know. Again, I'm not quite, like, I definitely do not see the similarity to The Furrows. Like, The Furrows just was doing a bunch of different things, and it didn't, you know, the novel didn't seem to even attempt to draw them all together, where I would say that's not true of this novel.
What does it draw them all together into? I mean, maybe you just said that, right? But I mean, humor me and repeat it if you did just say it.
I would say that it draws, everything is drawn together into I think we could draw everything back to the central concept of the eternal return, probably, in that, so, you know, I do enjoy being pedantic, but I don't want to sound pedantic, so I apologize in advance. So the eternal return has been variously thought about by various Nietzschean philosophers. I think the current favorite interpretation of the eternal return was put forth by this critic called Alexander Nehamas, who's a translator and Nietzschean scholar, and he suggested that it's not a cosmological idea, which some people have taken it to mean. It's more like an existential question about your inner self and your inner conflict. If you were presented with the idea that you would have to live the same life that you have lived and will continue to live until your death, if you had to live it over and over and over again, and it would be the same every time, the eternal return of the same, would you be crushed by the despair of that question, or would you laugh because you had already lived life without any regrets and to the fullest.
There's an effect that happens, I think, sometimes with like sophisticated essays or sophisticated philosophical concepts where you, if you reduce them to too simple a level, even though you might not be misrepresenting what they're saying, you still make them sound stupid, right? I mean, if the point of The Eternal Return is, well, if you had to live your life a bunch of times, would that be good or bad? If that'd be bad, maybe you should live better. Like,
it makes it absolutely.
Maybe I'm misrepresenting this. It makes it actually seem dangerously close to like generic motivational speaking, right? That's like some Tony Robbins shit.
Well, not that I disagree. Like,
unless I'm misrepresenting it.
You know? I would say you're not misrepresenting. I don't think you're misrepresenting what Nietzsche meant. We're probably, by not thinking about it in its historical context, you know, maybe we're doing a disservice to it. So if Nietzsche's the first guy who ever says this, and he's the first person to ever really think about this, which, you know, he kind of is, he's one of the first existentialists to think about, you know, what should we do with our individual lives in a meaningless world? Asking that question seems pretty important. Now, if you ask that today, it probably wouldn't have as much ring to it. And, you know, there's also another famous Nietzschean saying that he absolutely said, but is now a cliche: what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. You know, I don't think we're misrepresenting what he meant when we say that. It's just that now the idea has become so overused and so ingrained in our language that it doesn't sound very interesting or profound.
Has it become kitsch?
Maybe it has, which obviously Nietzsche would hate.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, I guess I hadn't really thought about the context of like the idea of like quote unquote living life to the fullest. I mean, that's so rooted in a particular sort of individualism, right? It's so rooted in a particular kind of egoist individualism that that, you know, supplants things like, I don't know, religion as it was experienced for most of human history.
Right. Absolutely.
That being said, if for the sake of understanding this novel, if we take that interpretation of the idea of eternal return, I mean, I guess my first question would be, if the eternal return just means, are you living life in a way that you would appreciate if you had to do it on a loop, does that align with how you think Kundera's understanding eternal return in this novel?
I don't know Eternal Return well enough to say, but I feel like the thing that I see kind of consistently in this novel is kind of modeled in the character's inability to achieve a state of like happiness. I guess like Tomas and Teresa, it's not as though they are living, you know, in a Hallmark card at the end, though. They have found, I think, something together, but it's because a lot of things were sort of taken away from them. And so there's something about the, you know, lightness and weight. There's something about, you know, the brief pleasure or satisfaction that comes from one or the other, or whatever sort of experience is giving you one or the other, that makes you believe as though you are, you know, this is it, this is the path, this is what I need. And then very quickly, like, you don't, that isn't it. And that's what I see in the novel. I don't know if that really, what that says about Eternal Return, maybe that even if you were to do, there's not really a way to be satisfied with your life in the way that the kind of thought experiment of the eternal return gives us or puts on us.
So you would say Kundera is interested in the idea of the eternal return, but is maybe critical of it or exposing like a weak point.
I don't, like I said, I don't know enough about eternal return to pick up where like maybe he's not doing that, but it does seem to me that if eternal return is this concept of, is this thought experiment of, if I had to live this life, am I live over and over and over again, would I marry this woman, you know, would I do this? I don't see any of these characters, given that perspective, actually making better choices, because the choices they make are just the choices they make. That's it. Like they are driven by rapidly vacillating urges to, you know, Franz is, you know, at one moment, you know, just done with Sabina, but then at the next, you know, not, or, you know, his wife or not. And it is that kind of bouncing back and forth that I think makes that very hard to say, like, the only thing that's keeping us from living our best life is the motivation to live a better life. I don't know that that makes sense in the context of these characters.
Yeah, I don't think it makes sense in the context of these characters at all, right? Because, I mean, for a couple reasons. I mean, partly because it seems like if you believe that Tomas and Teresa are happiest at the end of their lives, that's basically a happiness that they achieve by kind of submitting to forces beyond their control in a way, right? Which doesn't seem very Nietzschean to me. And based on a very kind of rough understanding, at least, of Nietzsche. I mean, they're essentially lying down and taking it. And, you know, that's what makes them happy. And then also the really incredible lack of understanding between the characters, Franz and Sabina in particular, right? It may be that the question of eternal return is framed as this kind of ego individualist living one's best life, self-actualization kind of thing. But it doesn't seem like the actions of the characters support that philosophy. It does tie in a little bit to the next question I had, which has to do, I think, with, again, with how Tomas and Teresa end up, right? And you know, one question that you and I were talking about, Sarah, is Tomas an asshole, right? And if he is an asshole, like, what is the nature of his assholishness? What is his core fault? And does his eventual achievement of happiness in connection with Teresa, does that redeem his earlier infidelity, his earlier lack of consideration for her?
So I think that reading the book first in high school and finding a lot of connections with it just because of the very dramatic looking title, which to carry around in high school is amazing and perfect. And I wanted everyone to know that this is unbearable. This is fucking unbearable. Like, please
perfect.
Do something.
Sure, man. Absolutely. Yeah,
absolutely. So beyond that, when I actually read the book some years later, not being 16 anymore and just full of angst, I mean, maybe yes, full of angst, but not being 16 anymore, that I think the beginning of the book, which I had to read, you know, 3 or 4 times over to really understand, are you just trying to blow philosophical smoke up my ass, or are you trying to set the tone for something? And it kind of seems like, I want you to look at this in such a way that these people's little lives and their little relationships are something that could bring you happiness if you just let go. And that brings me to Tomas's assholishness, in that he wants to move around the people in his life like little chess pieces. He wants to make sure that Teresa acts this way and Sabina acts this way and act this way around each other or around Franz or around anyone else that they know. He only allows himself to feel certain ways about Teresa. And I feel like that becomes his downfall.
I think I have to call out one of my favorite little like kernels. Tomas, at some point, I think like 2/3 of the way through the novel, meets a woman who does not strip when he tells her to strip. And it's like amazing. It's an incredible little like insight into his character that like this is like this is just something that he does with apparently hundreds of women. Is it's like his go-to card is to tell them to strip. Yeah, not a great look for Tomas.
Interestingly enough, though, doesn't he end up like making love with this woman who doesn't respond to him?
Oh yeah, he digs it.
Yeah, he's like all about it. Which would go back to the idea of giving up, right? Like if you relinquish some control, you are happier. If that's true, is that an anti-Nietzschean stance? I don't think so. Or I do think so, maybe. I don't know. Go on.
Well, the way that you put that, I think like does anyone on this, you know, podcast have a sense of like consistency to what lightness and weight refer to? Like I get a little bit that lightness is the sense of like disconnection that that Sabina, I think Sabina is maybe the easiest. So Sabina does not want prefers the affairs she has be kept private. And there's I think it's that's sort of posited as a kind of a lightness at some point in the novel that she kind of craves. But I feel like and then Teresa is kind of concerned at times because she has such a hard time achieving lightness. But I don't know that I had a consistent idea of what lightness and weight referred to. And I felt at times that like a character's sense of lightness, you know, could actually be weight, or you know, and so their sense of weight may be lightness, and like they almost seemed more about. They were almost more reflective of the cravings of the character at that time, and just sort of how they, sort of, position themselves in their own head, you know, and I don't know that, I guess like the question is like, and you kind of said this, Patrick, before I rudely interrupted, is submission submission, or is submission kind of a greater form of like asserting control?
Is submission lightness or is submission heaviness?
Yeah.
I don't know. I agree. I may not have gotten exactly a clear understanding of what represents what lightness and weight exactly are.
And you told me I was stupid for thinking this novel was hard to understand.
Yeah, I was wrong. I apologize.
I feel like we should have some sense of lightness and weight because it's in the fucking title, right? Like, off the top of my head, I think my instinct is to say that submission brings weight, and weight is good, right? Tomas and Teresa are fulfilled, happy at the end of the novel. They are, they've submitted to, I mean, I don't want to say that the message of the novel is to submit to fate necessarily, or that the message of the novel is that it's good to shrug when the communist regime takes away your livelihood and sense of purpose. But I mean, I suppose there are ways to approach that situation with dignity and meaning, and boy, I don't know.
But that makes sense to me, like the idea that weight is good in, at least as far as happiness and contentment are concerned. Like when people submit, they seem to be happier and they seem to enjoy things more. And that may, like, weight keeps you pinned takes away control, whereas lightness offers control, but it's unbearable. You float away. I like that.
And is the control that it offers in some way illusory? I mean, maybe. Sabina and Franz, you know, they're like, so much of the point of the Franz and Sabina passage is he just completely misunderstands everything, right? Like, he literally dies because he misunderstands Sabina's perspective on the fact that he has big muscles. And so, you know, I mean, I think that I don't have a great philosophical citation for this, but like, will in the absence of understanding is kind of meaningless, right? If you are exercising your will toward an illusory sense of the world, that's no good, you know? And so, I mean, Franz is willful in some sense. He's willful in the sense of trying to carry out what he thinks Sabina would want him to do politically. He's willful in the sense of trying to carry out what he thinks she would want him to do to kind of, you know, manifest the things that she admires about his physicality. And those things are stupid and wrong and humiliate him and get him murdered. And so, but then I suppose in some sense he is, when he does those things, submitting to, he's kind of made her this sort of kind of, I don't know if maybe God is too simple a word, right? But he's like made her this kind of icon, and he's trying to submit to what he thinks she would have him do, and failing at it catastrophically.
I wonder about the line of inquiry into and thinking about weight as good has me kind of thinking about Teresa a little bit differently, because she, it seems that it is unable to free herself from the weight of her commitment to Tomas, right? Like, she's submitted to this relationship that is very difficult I'll jump ahead. It's very difficult, but basically, does she save Tomas? Like, is her sort of commitment, because she briefly has an affair, like a tryst with somebody, and she briefly experiences lightness, and then she rejects that. She goes back to this very problematic marriage that that she has submitted to. And is that the kind of dedication to carrying that weight? Does that make her a hero in this novel?
It seems kind of retrograde if it does, doesn't it?
It kind of seems like if she is supposed to be the weight and maybe Sabina is supposed to be the lightness, because Teresa needs to be taken care of and she has to be managed. I mean, even from the beginning of their relationship, when she goes to Prague and she has all of her belongings, and Tomas is immediately afraid that if she brings all of her belongings, she will bring his life. Like, they will become one just because of that one choice that she's made. And she comes to the station and she doesn't get a hotel and she leaves her things there. And it's like a foregone conclusion that she's going to be with him. And then he goes on about how, you know, he has to make her wait because there's something, he has plans for that night. And why wouldn't he just send her right there? It seems like, if anything, he's getting in his own way of happiness because he refuses to be okay with the fact of how he feels about Teresa, or be honest with himself in a sort of not micromanaging kind of way.
But you think that if he, I guess another way to kind of put a spin on Hans's question and I don't know, get at this a different direction. Do you think that Tomas is an asshole, but savable, and the thing that is standing between him and happiness and being saved is something that is keeping him from committing to Teresa? Like, there is an answer there, but he's not seeing it.
I think that he's an asshole not on purpose. I think that he's living his best life the way that he knows how, but it turns out to be self-sabotage in a lot of ways because he makes himself miserable with all these questions of how can he have all of the things that he wants but still live a good life or still be a good person. But then it's like he only thinks about that, you know, 50% of the time. The other times he's just blindly following what he thinks is, you know, his desire or his path. And he doesn't ever look at the big picture of what actually might make him happy.
Yeah, he is a very unexamined... He's a character who lives, it seems to me, a very... Maybe this is another cliche, right? But a very unexamined life, right? I mean, he's not someone who thinks much about the reasons for what he does. And, I mean, getting back to the idea of eternal return, right? Looking at the thought if looking at the thought experiment of eternal return is meant to be something that allows us to evaluate how we're living, he's someone who, you know, really does not evaluate that about himself or for himself, is he? I mean, he acts in a very instinctive way.
Do any of the characters not act in an instinctive way? I mean, within the universe of this novel, within its context, I think that we're kind of shown to not have any real agency over the things that kind of like our compulsions or I'll take that back. Maybe we have agency, but these characters are, it's not just that they're sort of rejecting the things that, you know, would make them happy. It's just that they're so confused about what makes them happy. And they're kind of reacting to, you know, very strong feelings and compulsions in the moment. If I don't know what would make Tomas reject his philandering lifestyle and go to Teresa. Like, I don't know what would give him that clarity. He doesn't, it's in the moment, that's what he wants. He wants to be with lots of women.
So I'm thinking like to kind of maybe help this act of interpretation out or act of meaning making out. There are a couple of implications about the concept of the eternal return for human behavior. So on the one hand, the concept of the eternal return suggests that we should do things that we wouldn't regret doing no matter what. An example being, say, me deciding to go to Alaska to get a master's degree. Even though my dreams about working in academia and like having a publishing career and all that haven't really worked out the way that I wanted them to, I still have no regrets about going to Alaska, and I have no regrets about trying to publish things and trying to get that aspect of my life up off the ground. And, you know, a parallel in the book would be Tomas's womanizing, right? Like, I don't know in retrospect if he would regret those things, but definitely at the time, he feels like he wants to do them. The question of whether or not he should do them means the question of whether or not he should do them according to the concept of the eternal return is whether or not later on he would look back on that and think that it was stupid or something he shouldn't have done. So that's like one implication. Try not to do things that you regret, but also try to be more mindful of the things that you do, right? So, don't do things you would regret, and be mindful of the things that you end up doing so that you don't end up regretting them. So certainly Tomas, while he does want to, be a womanizer, he does want to have sex with all these women, he isn't, like you said, Hans, he's not really examining that. He's not mindful of it. So, we may be looking at these characters as examples of way of what not to do if the eternal return is true. That could be like something that we need to get out of this. But also, what I find interesting about things that have been said, like, Chris, you were talking about, like, it doesn't seem like these characters have any agency. They do the things that they want to do in the moment. Again, Nietzsche did not believe in free will. He believed in the will to power. So, meaning the thing that drives what we want to do and what we choose to do is some type of desire for power, right? So, obviously, if we were trying to like interpret this on a Nietzschean scheme, we would say that everything that these characters are doing is a way for them to feel powerful or achieve power, which goes back to the idea of control, right? Like, we do the things that we want to do to feel like we are in charge.
Yeah, you mentioned the idea of control, and we've talked a little bit about communication, right? And kind of things that are misunderstood or said or unsaid. And that makes me think a little bit of, there's a scene that I found very interesting that felt a bit like an unresolved threat or something. I don't know, but there's a striking scene that occurs relatively early in the novel where Teresa and Sabina take a series of nude photos of each other, right? And Teresa tells Sabina to strip. And that registers as significant, of course, because that's also a command that Tomas gives. And on some level, they probably have a mutual understanding that they both know what that word means in that context. And there's a moment there where it seems like they're sitting on the edge of some sort of breakthrough into a deeper understanding or connection. But, they end up backing away from that, right? There's like a moment where they're on the cusp of that, and then they kind of giggle and shut it down. So I'm just curious, on the one hand, like, how does that maybe tie into some of the larger ideas that we've had? And also, what does that suggest about female relationships or how women communicate? It seems like an interesting example to me, because I think, if you want to think about this from like a Bechdel test standpoint, right? Like, this is the only scene where two female characters are interacting without a man present.
Well, that means it passes, right?
Well, I'm not sure if they're talking about anything other than a man, right? They have to be talking about something that's not a man.
Oh, all right. That's right. They have to talk about, they not only have to, yeah.
Don't you know what we talk about when you're not there?
Maybe Kundera doesn't. So he was like, I guess they talk about like Tomas. And yeah.
He absolutely does not know anything. No, nothing about anything when it comes to women at all. Kundera is definitely the bigger asshole than Tomas. Yeah.
Yeah. Let's hear. That's interesting.
No. Yeah, his characterization of women, and
like if you think he sucks at women, yeah, I'd like to know how to write women better.
Yeah, he sucks at women. Well, he writes them in a way where unless they're talking to each other, and when they're talking to each other, they are definitely going to find a reason to take their clothes off. Like, absolutely every time. That is what we do. We get in a room together and we're like, wait a minute, you know what would make this better? If nobody had a shirt on, let's do this. I mean, I feel like that is his view of women and his conversation that they have together is just about Tomas, whether or not they say Tomas. And they don't get to branch out into anything else. And then they get to take their clothes off. And then they can't have sex because Tomas is not there. So that would not be okay. Why would they want to do that?
Yeah, you can feel Kundera's brain short-circuiting at that moment. Like, oh no, this cannot go in any other direction. It's just, yeah.
He's going to find the clit one day, but today is not the day.
In reality, my wife doesn't even think about me when I'm not in the room, you know? Right? You know, like, yeah. She's not going to spend time talking about me. Unless she's pissed.
Is it when your podcasts run too long?
Like, she's going to tell her sister, like, oh, his podcast ran too long. That bastard. And then, no, she won't even do that. Like I said, she doesn't think about me when I'm not around. I'm a cat to her.
Oh, I'm curious, Sarah, because like it feels like this book is important to you, but you have a very low opinion of the female characterization, and it sounds like of Kundera, at least certain aspects of Kundera. So, like, how do you reconcile that?
Well, I would say that the way I reconcile that is that the first time I read this, as I said, I was 16, and thought that this was just like the answer to everything, because he was saying that everything is meaningless. This all is dumb. We are all just making up the rules as we go along, and there is no right and there is no wrong. And if you are concerned with the right and the wrong, you are wasting your time. And I kind of think that that was the takeaway that I had as a 16 or 17 year old, but as now a 41 year old, it makes so much less sense to me that if I was looking for happiness, that I would find it in a philandering surgeon or anyone else for that matter, besides myself. I think that Kundera is an asshole because he thinks that women might be the answer to happiness for men, but if only they could get it right.
Which is of course, you know, like you said, the happiness is about an internal struggle. An internal conflict and an internal relationship. It's not about, the more it's based on, you know, like the more you base your self-esteem in relationships with others, the less happy you will be, right?
Maybe. I have no idea. I mean, I don't know if you can say that. Boy, and then we're getting a little bit far afield from the text of the novel here right now, which I normally really try to discourage, obviously. But like, I mean, if you the idea that happiness is an internal struggle that's not related to that shouldn't be derived from your relationships to other people, like that, I don't think that's remotely true. I mean, I couldn't just go live in a cabin in the middle of the woods with nobody around and not. And you know, I'd feel like shit.
Lots of people are happy that way.
Maybe I'm totally misrepresenting the point that you made. Well, lots of people are happy that way. I just don't think that I would be one of them.
I think I simply meant that, like, if you not necessarily, obviously, like, your level of happiness in relationship to other people depends on, like, what style of personality you have. Like, if you're an introvert, you often like being alone. If you're an extrovert, you often like being with other people. I guess what I'm meaning is more like sense of self-worth. Like, if you only derive your self-worth from others, that would be a problem, right?
Maybe.
All right, whatever.
Another passage that I don't really have a good segue into this, actually. It's going to be kind of an abrupt transition. But another passage that I found interesting discusses the nature of philandering, right? And it suggests that there are two types of womanizers, those who seek the dream of a particular ideal woman and those who seek to possess the endless variety of the female world. So I guess my question about that was, I mean, I'll be totally frank, it did register, having known a few people who were, you know, womanizers, either accidentally or on purpose, or, you know, having known a few people that went through a long string of short, unsuccessful affairs, that does actually resonate to me as being a reasonably sharp observation about the nature of masculine desire, right? But my question, I guess, is like, do you guys, am I right in reading that as a critique of masculine desire or male perspectives, or is it an endorsement, or is it fundamentally neutral? And does this novel offer a parallel vision of female desire?
I don't know. This feels like, it feels somewhat true, but it also feels somewhat limited, you know, like maybe like an aspect of, you know, it feels like, I'll be honest, I'm just going to say it. It feels like an aspect of Kundera. Like this feels like a Kundera sort of like almost more about how Kundera thinks about male desire than about something that is, you know, broadly true. I think I agree, Hans. I think that there's, you know, definitely some men that I've known who fit into one or both of these categories. I don't necessarily, I guess they're mutually exclusive, but it still doesn't feel like it's encompassing or comprehensive. It feels more like a reflective of how Kundera thinks about male desire to me.
So it's an endorsement. He thinks this is true.
Well, does he think it's problematic? Does he think that these are problematic perspectives or problematic mental habits? Or does the novel suggest these are problematic habits or perspectives?
I don't know if it does it. It doesn't seem to me, other than if...
It's either neutral or an endorsement. I don't think he's critiquing it. Oh. You know, I don't think he's saying it's bad. Maybe he's simply saying it is.
I think it can simultaneously... I think Tomas's womanizing can simultaneously be the thing that is keeping him from being more content, if we accept that Teresa, a marriage of fidelity to Teresa is the thing that would give him more happiness. If that is true, I think we can say that his womanizing is between him and that happiness. But we can also, I think, still say that and say that the womanizing itself is not a problem. Like, not as it's portrayed in this book. I don't think that it is something that is criticized.
Right. Like, I don't think that, like, Kundera is, you know, showing us Tomas's behavior of womanizing and being like, look at this asshole, look at this utter jerk. Maybe he is more like, look at this guy, he's doing what he wants to do, and he doesn't realize that he could be happier if he didn't do it.
Yeah, no, that's perfect. I like that, Patrick.
Oh, awesome. I'm glad I said something worthwhile.
But what we like to do is arbitrary. Like, basically, like, it doesn't matter. Like, a lot of characters are shown doing what they like to do and then shown being unhappy with that regardless. So it doesn't, it's not a critique of womanizing that this doesn't actually make him happy. It's just that he needs to be arrested, that all of that, these options need to be taken away from him.
Right.
The power to do this needs to be taken away from him.
So if he had listened to the implication of the eternal return and been more mindful, he could have been happier. But now he's doomed to this stupid behavior on a loop for the repetition of the universe.
Assuming that one takes the eternal return in a cosmological sense, which I think you had said earlier is
we're not now supposed thought to do.
Be inaccurate.
Yeah. Egg on your face, Patrick. Egg on your face.
Yeah. Yeah. You're right.
It's interesting to me, you know, one of the questions that I had raised in the list that I sent to you had to do with the political perspective of this novel, right? And it's interesting that we're reading a novel about life under a totalitarian state, right? Not maybe the most effective or efficient or total of totalitarian states, right? But in some sense, a totalitarian state. It's got a lot of play in the joints, but that's what it's trying to do. We're reading this novel about life under a totalitarian state, and we're coming away with the idea that the way to happiness is submission and letting go of one's kind of unexamined urges and desires, right? Is that dissonant? I mean, surely this is not an endorsement of life in the Soviet era for people in Czechoslovakia. But how do we fit the ideas that we have about free will and submission that we've kind of been developing in this analysis, how do we fit that into the political context that really is a pretty significant part of the novel?
Well, in one of his little essayistic asides, Kundera does say that the Communist Party is like essentially kitsch, right? It's total kitschness. So we definitely know that the novel is against kitschness. It hates kitschness. So we can certainly be certain that it's not endorsing, you know, the totalitarianism that it represents. My original thought was that the novel is playing with like the same idea that 1984 plays with, you know, where Winston and Julia in 1984 have this secretive but very riotous and passionate affair, and the novel is very explicit about how the totalitarian regime that they suffer under, which is essentially Stalinism, hates when people have individual passions like, you know, lust. So the prescriptions against enjoying sex in 1984 are all about maintaining control. So my thought was, you know, on the one hand, we've got Tomas the womanizer in this novel who, you know, is enjoying these riotous passions versus the totalitarian regime. So I thought it was, originally that was my thought, that it's being set up like that, but upon reflection, I'm not sure that that works that well, because like Hans, you said, it's loose. It's not the totalist of totalitarianisms, but certainly it doesn't seem like his sexual proclivities are directly hindered by the regime. Now he does have to give up his womanizing when they move to the country, but I'm forgetting, is that a result of his article where he first has to give up his job and then later they have to move to the country to take him out of the limelight? Is that why?
I don't think they have to move to the country because of that. I mean, he has to give up his job because of that, but my impression is that there's no political reason that he couldn't just be a philandering window washer until the day he dies. I mean, it doesn't really seem like the communist regime has any particular interest in
right.
his fidelity to Teresa.
Right.
Or in him having all the fun he wants to, sexually.
So speaking. that was my original thought, but upon reflection, I don't think it works. It's ambiguous. I'm not quite sure, like, how those two things mesh together.
Do you know what it makes me think of a bit? And I don't know if I can, this is kind of an intuitive connection. I don't know if I can draw it, but I'll give it a shot here. A few months ago, we read No One Is Talking About This by Patricia Lockwood. And for those who haven't read it, what happens in that novel, essentially, spoiler alert, I guess, if you haven't read it, then skip ahead a few minutes. But among other things, the kind of core story of the novel is the protagonist's sister has a baby with very, very severe developmental disabilities, who only lives maybe less than a year. And there's an interesting framework on choice in that novel, where the novel is very explicitly, I think, it's hard not to read it in an explicitly pro-choice way, right? Where it's the sister has to have this child because of Ohio laws, but when she has the child that she probably would not have in the absence of this law, this, you know, quasi-totalitarian abortion restriction, the having of this severely developmentally disabled baby becomes this incredibly transcendent thing that brings them a surprising amount of joy, and everybody kind of grows and deepens. But that doesn't change the fact that they should have had a choice about whether or not to do that experience, right? Even though the choice that was forced upon them ultimately helps them grow. And there's a paradox there that you can't really reconcile, right? It's the nature, I suppose, of choice and will. And there's something a bit like that, I suppose, here, right? Where relinquishing his lifestyle is beneficial, but at the same time, it's not, you don't read it thinking that Kundera would endorse kind of people forcibly having to give up the lives that they've chosen, right? I don't know if I made that connection well enough, but. All right, well, that leaves us on a bit of an unresolved note, I suppose. I don't know if I have a great way to tie all these thoughts together, except to say that, I mean, I think it's maybe a book which allows for a certain amount of ambiguity in terms of how things add up, or, you know, how things, it's not necessarily, like I said at the top of the segment, even though it's on a sequence to sequence level, it's very explicit about what it's saying thematically. I think the ultimate statement that coheres to is perhaps a bit fuzzier than you might expect.
Yeah. I was wrong.
Any last thoughts, anybody? Yeah, the whole point of that, I carefully staged that whole sequence so that Patrick could be proven right. Wrong. It's Tracy actually asked me to do that. She asked me to create like a humbling sort of thing.
Did
for
she?
You.
Yeah, man. She's thinking about it even yeah. now.
Oh,
she wanted to know it was gonna happen.
That I was humbled. Oh, man.
She also asked me to humble you in under an hour, though, so she's going to be mad at me. Are there any last thoughts anybody has about this work that you wanted to share before I wrap us up?
I want to share one thing. I am willing to say that I was wrong in the beginning. This was more ambiguous and hard to talk about than I predicted. However, I have been right in the past. And that's... Like, there are times when I've been dead right.
So you've been right in the past.
So it's okay.
I've been there. I was there in the room or on the
exactly.
call.
Like, just, yeah. Like, I'm right in almost every single episode. Like, if you go back, I'll be right 95% of the time. So it's fine.
I don't know about that. I'm not gonna endorse that.
Oh, what?
Can I just tell you that I listened to this podcast of my own.
Oh, creation. Sarah.
No one's forcing me to. Yes. From week to week, I listen awesome. To this podcast, and I have yet to know that you are right.
What? Oh, God.
That seems.
Jesus. Jesus.
I don't know why you're aiming for me. Like, what did I ever do to you?
In my defense, I do spend 99% of my time with people who are 5 and under. So when faced with adults, I'm not really very good at it. So I might just fall back on kindergarten politics and just like tell you you have a big butt or something. Is that better?
No, if I
basically
I haven't been right, There's nothing to say about it.
No, you wounded Patrick in the way of the brilliant way a child can wound. So you have sharp knives there, Sarah.
I get them from my bosses, who are all, as I said, 5.
I was gonna say I really enjoy reading this novel and then thinking about it I feel like there is almost a kind of a paradox in it that, like, I don't know that Kundera kind of goes out of his way to make it so that, like, you can't really assemble anything, like, useful from it. I don't think that's meant as a kind of a joke, or, you know, because of this novel's, I think the tension between like seeking like meaning or seeking happiness and then just sort of being and accepting and submitting. I don't know what to do with a lot of the like stuff that's covered in this novel. And so I think on the whole, I enjoy the experience of reading it quite a bit more than the experience of thinking about it. I do enjoy thinking about it for about 10 minutes or 20 minutes, but an hour and 15 minutes into a podcast, I feel like I don't need to think about it anymore.
What an endorsement to our listeners. You just... Here, listeners, you just listened to an hour and 15 minutes of garbage.
No, it was a good talk.
Just go read the fucking
book.
Just go read
the book. It's way better.
It's way, way better, better than us talking about it. Sure.
All right. So whose turn is it? Is it Patrick? You again?
Yeah, I typically go after you. Is that... I have a pick.
Patrick, it's your turn.
It's my turn. Okay. So let's read The Mayor of Casterbridge by Thomas Hardy. It is... It's the main reason I chose it is because, there are certain ethical questions that rise up in The Mayor of Casterbridge that also kind of rise up here in The Unbearable Lightness of Being. And I think it's super ambiguous. I'm not sure how to take the novel, but it's super good. It's about a guy who sells his wife and daughter in the first chapter for some booze. But most of the novel picks up 20 years later, where he is now the mayor of a town called Casterbridge and has seemingly turned his life around. But is that true? Let's find out.
All right. You heard it first here, folks. Our next episode will be on Thomas Hardy's The Mayor of Casterbridge. Thank you much, everybody, for listening to the Book Spider podcast. Special thanks to our guest for today, Sarah Ashcraft, for joining us. And I hope that you all have a good rest of your afternoon. Gentlemen, lovely to talk to you as always.
Uh-huh. Lovely to talk to you.
Nice to meet you, Sarah.
Nice to meet you, Sarah. Thank you for coming on.
Nice to meet you too. Thanks for having me. Thanks for letting me play library with you.
Bye.